Welcome back to the Speakeasy Podcast,
part of the Cosmic Shambles Network.
I'm your host, Bruce Hood. Now this week we're going to do something slightly different. Normally we have contributions from experts around the country and in some cases around the world. But this week, all of our speakers come from Bristol and have recently taken part in the Bristol Heats of the 3-Minute Thesis competition. And so we invite them into our recording studio where they could reproduce their presentations. But I also got the chance to have a conversation with them afterwards to find out a little bit more. So the podcast is slightly longer this week, but there's no introductory music or sound effects. So let's get straight into it. First up is James Fleming.
I was walking home the other day when I saw this beautiful red tulip, and I had to stop myself. What if I told you that tulips aren't red? Or rather, that tulips don't care what colour you think they are beyond whether or not you plant them in your garden. They do care what colour bees think they are, and bees don't think that they're red. Humans see colour through 3 detectors in their eyes that each respond best to one of the 3 primary colours, red, green, and blue. The other colours we see are shades between them. Bees also have 3 detectors, but for them, the primary colours are blue, a kind of yellow-green, a bit like the snot from my cold last week, and ultraviolet, a colour beyond violet that we can't see. But I'm a paleontologist, which means I'm interested in extinct animals and the vision of extinct animals. Most of all, the trilobites. Trilobites look a lot like woodlice, but they are actually more closely related to spiders. They turned up about 500 million years ago and went extinct about 250 million years ago. As we can now learn more about the colours of fossils, if we can work out what the trilobites were trying to see and what was trying to be seen or not by them, we can gain an unprecedented insight into extinct environments. I can use the detectors of living animals to learn more about the history of extinct ones by building trees of relationships, like a family tree. For example, if a bee's blue and ultraviolet detectors are more closely related to each other than anything else, the bee must have developed the ability to see in blue and ultraviolet on its own. But if we have all of the insect blue detectors in one group, and all of the insect ultraviolet detectors in another, the first insect must have been able to see in both blue and ultraviolet. We can expand this idea, bringing in detectors from the crabs and lobsters, the centipedes and millipedes, the spiders and scorpions. This can tell us the detectors that were shared by the ancestor of all of these creatures. And the trilobites? Well, just like the bee, they were able to see in ultraviolet, that snotty yellow-green, blue, and a new colour, a kind of tealy blue-green. I'd like to give you a bit of a challenge on the way home today. When you see a bird or a plant and think, oh, that's lovely, or, that's a bit dull, just stop and think, am I the intended audience?
Well, that's great, James. And as a psychologist, I find the things you were talking about resonate a lot with the whole notion of how perception works. But how did you get into this? Can you tell me a little bit about what got you into studying these ancient visual systems?
I did my master's degree here at the University of Bristol in the taxonomy of fossilized insects.
Can you explain what a taxonomy is?
So I was defining the species of a fossil deposit that we'd found in Somerset. And along the way, I found some of these head fossils, and I thought, well, these are lovely. These are really great. So when I was offered the chance to do a PhD studying these visual systems, I immediately leapt at the chance.
Now, quite often, some members of the audience listening, they ask, well, what's the relevance? Is it just a pure fantasy of academic interest, or is there any application, do you think?
Paleontology is very much, it is a science of academic interest. I think it's a great chance for us to just kind of expand our general knowledge about the world. But when we learn more about the visual systems of these creatures, we learn a lot more about how to behave around them. We can build our environments to avoid possible pests and to make sure that we're not causing undue stress to the other organisms that live around us. For example, in Africa, using coloured flypaper has meant that parasite-deploying flies are now more likely to land on paper that they like.
That's amazing.
Rather than papers they don't like.
That's absolutely fascinating. I mean, I don't think really we should have to make excuses for why we study things which are just fascinating and curious. And actually, if it has some application, that's always an added bonus.
But I think just the pursuit is just interesting and justifying in itself.
Mm. Basic science is really important, and this kind of very academic science can often seem quite detached, but often gives us an ability to set down building blocks to understand more application science that we otherwise might not have done as well.
Well, James, thank you for coming in. That's really fascinating, and good luck with the PhD.
Oh, thank you.
That was James Fleming telling us about his work. Next, we have Puni Rooney, who works in education, and she's going to explain this issue of mindset and why it's so important in the classroom.
So have you ever wondered why some people are so good at persevering towards their goals, even when faced with obstacles or failure, while others simply give up? I first started puzzling over this when I was a maths teacher. I observed a great deal of variability amongst my students. And it turns out that perseverance really does matter, not just for their academic success, but for other life outcomes such as health, wealth, and well-being. So if perseverance really does matter, then we need to understand what makes adolescents persevere, but also, and perhaps more importantly, how we can change their life outcomes by cultivating perseverance. My research to date has shown that there are two student characteristics that matter most for predicting academic perseverance in adolescents. The first and most important factor is something that we refer to as academic self-efficacy. This is basically a student's perception of their competence in tackling academic tasks. What's really interesting is that it's not the student's actual competence, but rather their perception of it that affects their ability to persevere. The second factor is something called a mindset about intelligence. It turns out that students can be broadly divided into two groups. Those with a fixed mindset, who believe that intelligence is fixed and innate, and they espouse to the idea of effortless genius. They are the ones who are likely to give up when the going gets tough. Can we cultivate perseverance in adolescence by targeting these factors? And I hope that you agree with me that this is a question worth persevering towards.
Puni, that's okay. Really fascinating. So is this the work of Carol Dweck?
So some of it is Carol Dweck and some of it is Bandura's work. But I've tried to look at two key areas, really. Overall academic performance, but also academic performance in a particular subject. Mm-hmm. And try to understand what helps students persevere, whether it's the same things mm-hmm. in both areas.
So is it the case where the mindset in one topic actually generalizes to the performance and other topics? Is this a kind of general view, or is it specific to topics, do you think?
So I think, generally speaking, most people are perhaps more similar across different areas than they're different. However, there are specific areas, such as maths, for example, where we see that discrepancy between their overall mindset. So you might have someone who might have good academic self-efficacy across a lot of subjects, but maths might be their blind spot. So they might not like maths and think that they can't do it.
We know that there's a real problem with gender here. There is a stereotype that girls aren't as good at maths mm-hmm. as boys. And as far as I'm aware, there's not a lot of evidence in terms of performance until they reach a certain age, and then you get this incredible shift. Is that the case?
That's definitely what the research has shown. If you're looking at them beyond GCSEs, more on A-levels and then performance in higher education, that girls and tend not to even opt for those subjects. Yeah. So this perseverance towards those subjects at higher levels does seem to be affected by their self-efficacy. The first study that I have completed right now, my pilot, I looked at gender differences between boys and girls, and there were no real significant differences between the two groups. However, this was a small sample of around 100, and it was mainly with sixth form students, and you could say that those who are in sixth form are perhaps more likely to persevere with academic performance, and perhaps they're not representative. I'm currently collecting data in schools where I'm looking at this at across many different ages in secondary school to try and see, are there patterns between gender? I'm also going to be looking at other factors such as socioeconomic factors, and also maths ability setting, because maths is one of the very few subjects in schools where students are assigned to an ability group. And that in itself is communicating the idea that intelligence is fixed. You belong to this group and this is basically what you're capable of. So I'm trying to look at whether that kind of banding or grouping of students actually affects their competence sort of levels.
So is the plan at some point to introduce interventions which shift their mindsets?
That's it, yeah. So far there have been a few different types of interventions, quite brief interventions that have been very, very successful at manipulating students' mindset. But also there are some that have tried to tinker with their self-efficacy. So my goal is to try to introduce these brief interventions. They're going to be one-to-one just for the sake of getting good data initially and basically looking at the students. I've already collected their data on self-efficacy and mindset prior to this, and then they have the intervention, and then I'm looking at how does that also impact their perseverance, and hoping that we will see positive results.
Well, thank you very much for coming in, Puni, and good luck with your research. And of course, if anybody would like you to come and speak to them, they'll be able to find you on the website, and get in touch with Puni, and she'll be able to tell you all about her research and mindset and performance. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Puni Rooney telling us about her research on mindset in the educational setting. Finally, we have Alfie Wern, who went on to actually win the Bristol Heats of the 3-Minute Thesis competition.
When was the last time you walked into a room before realising you have no idea what you went in there for? How many times have you been late for work because you've forgotten where you put your keys? Now, the truth is everyone experiences moments like these from time to time. But how can we tell the difference between benign lapses in memory like this and the early signs of something more serious, something like Alzheimer's disease? Alzheimer's disease is the world's leading cause of dementia. It's characterized by increasingly worsening memory to the point where even close friends and family members can be completely forgotten. In my PhD, I'm helping to develop tests which can identify Alzheimer's disease before the symptoms have become anywhere near that severe. You see, Alzheimer's disease is a neurodegenerative disease. This means that part of the brain literally break down. And the part of the brain that breaks down first in Alzheimer's disease is the part responsible for making memories stick, for making them last in your head. A part of the brain called the hippocampus. Now, the hippocampi of healthy people are nice and big and plump and juicy and functional. They can make memories last for a lifetime. Now, Alzheimer's disease reduces the hippocampus to basically nothing, which is why patients cannot make memories stick for very long at all. Now, this damage is irreversible. It's irreversible, but it might be possible that in coming years we will develop a treatment which stops Alzheimer's disease from getting worse, or at least slows it down. If these treatments are to be maximally effective, we need to be able to identify symptoms before the hippocampus has broken down. So how do we go about detecting it so early? Well, you can visualize the hippocampus and the way it sticks to pieces of new information, like flies getting caught in a spider's web. Now, you know that if a spider's web is damaged, it won't be able to make flies stick for very long at all. They'll very quickly just buzz right off. Likewise, a hippocampus damaged by Alzheimer's disease is much less effective at making memories stick, and new memories will very quickly be forgotten. Now, at the moment, we only really investigate someone for Alzheimer's disease if they fail to remember, say, a list of words for about 30 minutes. But I do not believe that a memory has to be particularly sticky to remain stuck in the brain for just half an hour. That's why in my PhD, I'm extending the time point at which we test people's memory from 30 minutes to 4 weeks, and by much more rigorously testing the stickiness of people's memory at this much later time point, I'm hoping we'll be able to identify tiny amounts of damage to the hippocampus, which means we'll be able to diagnose Alzheimer's disease at the absolute earliest stages, such that we might hope to treat it, and maybe even stop it, before it's even really begun.
Well, that's great, Alfie. Now, of course, I'm a psychologist, and this is very familiar territory to me, but you're not a psychologist, are you?
No, I don't really have a psychology background. I came into this a little bit clueless, so I've had a lot of learning to do.
So tell me about the team that you're working with.
So I work with Dr. Liz Coulthard up at Southmead Hospital, and Professor Risto Kalpanen is my supervisor for the MRI side of things. So right. one thing I haven't mentioned in here at all is we do a lot of MRI scans.
Okay.
And we measure the size of the hippocampus. So I'm working with the Remember Group at Southmead Hospital.
Right.
Who are highly involved in developing tests for diagnosing Alzheimer's.
So is the idea that if you develop more sensitive tests, that means that you can do interventions earlier? Is that
that's the plan? So there is some hope that in maybe 5 or 10 years we will, or someone will develop a treatment which can slow the progression of Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously for then it would be it's very important that we can diagnose it at a stage much earlier than we currently can, before the symptoms have gotten so severe that there's not much point in stopping it. But even before those treatments come out, it's important for us to be able to diagnose it early and be able to predict which people are going to get Alzheimer's disease for things like clinical trials, which need defined groups. Mm. So, for example, if you need a drug, if a drug's going to come out, you need the group defined as a group which is, this group is likely to get dementia. So we can give these people the drug and see if in the future it stops them getting the dementia that we predicted.
Now, I'm a bit older than you, and I've noticed that my memory's starting to lapse at times. So how can you be sure that you're dealing with a pathology as opposed to just variation?
Yeah, that's a very good point. We spend a lot of time in the group trying to dissociate between what is normal aging and what is memory loss due to something like Alzheimer's disease. So all of our studies involve control groups who are age-matched to the patient groups with early-stage dementia. So we can compare the data, what you'd normally get in aging, from people who don't have any signs of dementia, from people who have mild cognitive impairment, for example, which is often viewed as a early-stage pre-Alzheimer's disease, if you will.
Great. Now, I understand that you won the Bristol Heats of the three-minute thesis. How was that for you doing that?
It was amazing. I wasn't expecting to win at all. There were some, fantastic candidates there.
And do you see this kind of communication as an important part of your training?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I even before I started at Bristol, I saw things like the three-minute thesis competition, and I thought I'd really like this opportunity to get involved in more public engagement things, not just the three-minute thesis, but, you know, Research Without Borders Festival as well.
Excellent.
Things like that, and it's something I wanted to do, and I'm glad I had the opportunity to do it.
Well, thank you for coming along. And if you liked what Duffy was saying and you'd like him to come and talk to your group, or you just want to ask him some questions, or you're just interested more about his research, then Duffy's going to create a profile on Speakeasy. Drop him a line and tell him about your group. And you never know, you might get an expert in dementia coming along to speak to your group. Thanks, Duffy.
Thanks very much.
That's all for now. Bye for this week. I've been your host, Bruce Hood.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Speakeasy Podcast, part of the Cosmic Shambles Network, a digital hub for curious minds. Head to cosmicshambles.com for more podcasts, documentaries, blogs, and more from the likes of Robin Ince, Josie Long, Helen Chersky, and Brian Cox, and many, many more.